anti-war protests around the world as the CIA calls for lifting a ban on assassination and working with human rights abusers. We'll talk to Jennifer Harbury. And as Bush prepares for war, religious activists mobilize for peace. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! In Exile's War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Bush has asked Congress for authority to waive all existing restrictions on U.S. military assistance and weapons exports for the next 5 years to any country if he determines the aid will fight against international terrorism. The waiver would cover those nations currently ineligible for U.S. military aid because of their sponsorship of terrorism, such as Syria and Iran, or because of their nuclear and offensive weapons programs or lack of commitment to democracy, which he says would include Pakistan and China. Separately, on Saturday, Bush lifted all military and economic restrictions on India, and he also removed restrictions that barred Pakistan from economic assistance and that prevented it from making commercial military purchases from U.S. companies. The new proposal would also allow the president to lift restrictions based on human rights concerns that have been imposed by Congress on U.S. military cooperation with other countries, such as Turkey, Colombia, Indonesia, and others involved in massive human rights abuses. The blanket approach has raised outrage on Capitol Hill and among human rights groups that it risks undermining the hard-fought legal architecture that ensures that human rights concerns can be considered in U.S. military sales and training. As State Department legal spokesperson said, the blanket waiver would apply to all current prohibitions, including those related to human rights, terrorism, and non-payment of debt. The most sweeping human rights provision currently in effect is the so-called Leahy Law, which since 1997 has imposed limits on U.S. military assistance to all countries where rights abuses have been found within military and security forces. Taliban Defense Minister Mullah Obaidullah said today, Afghanistan is mobilizing an additional 300,000 men to help fight off any U.S. attack to punish Kabul for sheltering Osama bin Laden. Hundreds of thousands more were signing up to help fight a jihad or holy war against any U.S. invasion, Obaidullah said in a statement sent to Reuters in Kabul. He did not reveal the current size of the army, but Afghan analysts in Pakistan say it cannot be more than about 45,000 and may be depleted by defections as concern over threatened U.S. military action mounts. The leader of Taliban militia said today the United States must withdraw forces from the Gulf and support the Palestinians in their conflict with Israel if it wants to remove the threat of terrorism. In a statement faxed to news agencies, Mullah Mohammed Omar said the death of Osama bin Laden would do little to remove the threat against the United States. The brief statement appeared aimed not only at warning the United States against military action, but also at encouraging other Muslim nations to distance themselves from Washington's efforts to build an international coalition to combat terrorism. Meanwhile, the Taliban say they are trying to find Osama bin Laden. Signs were that the reclusive Mullah Omar was engaged in delicate political maneuvering to try to stave off attack by the world's mightiest army without being seen by his followers and the Muslim world to be abandoning bin Laden. The most wanted man in much of the world, with the United States raising the price on his head, is venerated by many Sunni Muslims who see him as striking back against U.S. imperialism. But the Mullah, Abdul Hai Mutmain, Taliban chief spokesperson, said the Taliban would not hand over the man named as the prime suspect in the September 11th devastating attacks in the United States that killed nearly 7,000 without proof of his involvement. He said by telephone from Kandahar, we rule out the possibility of his handover to America without substantial evidence. This news from Washington. Congressman Gary Condit, whose career was crumbling under scandal just 2 weeks ago, has been named to a new House subcommittee on Homeland Security. in late August, House leaders signaled they wanted to remove the California Democrat from the House Intelligence Committee after he gave evasive answers to police and reporters about his relationship with missing intern Chandra Levy. But the tragedy September 11th has wiped Condit from the headlines and enabled him to take a prominent place on the front lines of national defense. The task force was turned into a formal subcommittee late last week to work with and oversee President Bush's new anti-terror czar, Pennsylvania Governor Tom Ridge. President Bush named Ridge to direct the Office of Homeland Security, a new cabinet-level position. Ridge will resign as governor October 5th. As Pennsylvania governor, his social agenda included dismantling welfare and a special legislative session on crime that gave birth to a three-strikes law and a faster death penalty process. Ridge has signed more than 200 execution warrants since becoming governor in 1995, including two death warrants for Mumia Abu-Jamal.
I had a perfect view, and the plane was coming in. I noticed it a second before it hit the building.
Train, entering the city. I lost myself and never came back. Took a trip around the world and never came back. Black silhouettes, crisscross tracks. Never came back. Thought ever changed.
They come by and they say, what happened?
A moment that will change everyone's life in this country, certainly here in New York City.
You just got to say, something hit the building, and then something hit both buildings.
Like a commercial plane, not a small plane. And I kept thinking, this is too low, it's too low, it's too low. And then it went right in.
Me and my coworkers were sitting at our desks. All of a sudden, the building just swayed.
I know there are 50,000 people who work in the World Trade Center. I know that every ambulance and every fire company in the city and has been called in and dispatched there.
We carried a bunch of people that we found laying in the debris. It was complete darkness. We stumbled over some people. We picked them up and carried them across the street.
My name is Joe Macaluso. I just want my mother and my family to know I'm alive. I was on the 34th floor when the planes hit. We didn't know what happened.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved.
Emergency, produced by Peter Boshen, here on Democracy Now! In Exile's War and Peace Report, as we break the sound barrier. I'm Amy Goodman. Thousands of people marched across New York on Friday night to call for peace and demand an end to attacks on Muslim and Arab communities, chanting, "War is not the answer and Islam is not the enemy." The marchers work their way uptown from Union Square, where mourners have been holding nightly vigils for the missing and the dead since the Twin Towers were attacked on September 11th. The march was called on short notice by New York Direct Action Network and a loose anti-war coalition. It grew to be much larger than organizers expected. As the numbers swelled, hecklers called out to them in Midtown's busy streets, and many bystanders cheered the marchers or even joined in. As the march approached Times Square, where the Army recruiting station is, police began sectioning off groups of demonstrators from each other to break up the march, letting demonstrators out of barricaded areas only three or four at a time. Four marchers were arrested, three charged with disorderly conduct, and one with criminal impersonation. Before the march began, activists from the religious, Arab, and South Asian communities held a Muslim peace rally in a nearby park. Because police had revoked their rally permit and the organizers didn't feel safe without police protection, speakers addressed a small audience. Among them were Karen Robinson of the Human Rights Education Project at Amnesty International, followed by New York City Councilwoman Christine Quinn.
Salam, shalom, shanti, peace. We are here today to express our shock and grief at the tragic loss of lives due to the attack on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. Our thoughts and prayers are with those who have lost family members or loved ones and those who are missing. As Muslims, we condemn the heinous crime, grieve and mourn with our fellow Americans, and stand in solidarity with them.
Yes, on behalf of Amnesty International, our heartfelt sympathy goes out to the family and friends of the thousands of missing, dead, and injured people of last week's horrendous actions. And we condemn those actions as the ultimate violation of one's human rights. But as in the United States and our allies start to seek justice and hold the perpetrators accountable for those actions, we demand that they uphold human rights and that our actions do not violate the human rights of the thousands of citizens around the world that we potentially may violate.
That's right.
To that same end, Eleanor Roosevelt, at the 10-year anniversary of the UDHR, said, "Where, after all, do human rights start? They start in small places." And Amnesty International is appalled that in this country, Arab Americans and Muslims and people who have a certain look are being targeted and attacked and killed in their community for nothing more than what they look like. And we deplore this as an organization, again, as a violation of people's human rights. And as we move forward, healing from this tragedy, seeking justice, we ask that all of us remember the principles of human rights and what that means in your community and the actions that you can take, and voice your opinions to the U.S. government that we must live up to human rights law and humanitarian law in any of the actions we take, and that people who violate the rights of citizens of this country for nothing more than what they look like should also be held accountable.
My name is Christine Quinn, and I'm a member of the New York City Council. I actually represent the area where you are now standing. I'm sad that people in New York and Americans have responded to the tragedy at the World Trade Center by attacking other Americans and attacking New Yorkers. You know, we've all expressed our condolences to the families and the victims of the World Trade Center tragedy. And in fact, the officers from the 13th Precinct who are here with us today, two of their fellow officers are missing, you know, because they rushed down to help save people. I fail to understand how harassing or beating or hurting another human being will help any of the victims or their families. Attacking someone because you think they're South Asian, you think they're Muslim, you think they're Arab, will not bring one person back. It will not raise the World Trade Center back up, and it will never take us to where we were in our own minds and souls on September 10th. The only thing that perpetrating bias against another person because of their perceived race, ethnicity, or religion, the only thing that does is bring us all further apart, commit more crimes, and separate and divide us. So I'm here today to say that my office is fully supportive of this effort to stop this violence in New York City and across the country. And everything we can do, we will do as we move forward, and to make sure that the healing in this city includes creating unity between the Muslim, Arab, South Asian community and those who are not Muslim, South Asian, or Arab, and that what we foster is peace and unity, not horrible, tragic bias and violence. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
They want to go to war, and especially against the people of the Middle East. And we feel that this government is using this horrific tragedy that happened on September 11th as an excuse to widen a war against the peoples of the Middle East. Why they're bombing a poor country like Afghanistan? You know, a country whose government the U.S. has been supporting since the late 1970s. And we just feel that this is not the best way to honor the memory of the 6,000 plus people who lost their lives in the World Trade Center. What's going to happen to the families of these victims? War is not going to help them. They're going to need compensation. They're going to need a moratorium on foreclosures and layoffs. And, you know, so we just feel that there's a growing opposition to war. We're here to, in terms of being in the streets, to show the people of New York that the majority of people, we represent the majority of people in this city, in this country, who do not want a war.
Simply being somebody who doesn't believe in what's going on now and not being able to verbalize that in my work at work and like not being able, feeling afraid to say that to ordinary people I might want to talk to on the street because they'll say it because I'm not American, oh, go back home. I don't even want to have to deal with that. So that kind of thing, I'm feeling pressure. But I just feel like a lot of people don't know another way and there hasn't been enough energy spent on what other ways, you know, can be used to whatever, quote unquote, to like end terrorism. That word is even kind of shady for me. And so, yeah, like that's what I'm against, or that's what I have problems with. Because you'd have to like sit and educate like whoever you're talking to about all the stuff that's been done to other countries and why possibly somebody might feel that it was necessary to attack the U.S. like that. And that takes so much time that you don't really have when somebody's reacting on pure emotion because they're afraid and they've never been in this situation before.
I do feel that racist climate in this city. Like, I'm South Asian, I'm not an Arab, which for me doesn't really make a difference because it's an arbitrary line, but that, yeah, that in a way that I never have before in New York, and I've lived here for 5 years, been stared at, and I've been in very, very negative ways. I've been like followed. So
recently?
Yeah, as recently as a couple hours ago.
They killed innocent people down there,
right.
And we shouldn't defend ourselves.
No.
You guys are a disgrace. A goddamn disgrace, you guys are.
Guy, just calm down.
People spilled their blood for this country. You guys are a disgrace.
You're right.
You're a goddamn disgrace. I'm a disgrace. You put it. You shouldn't even turn your head. You don't even have the right to look at me. I'm a disgrace. You don't even have the right to look at me. God damn it.
After thinking about it, you have to want peace. I don't want World War III. World War III would be awesome. Devastating. It'd rip at the heart of America.
Peace, not war, the message of the large anti-war protest in New York this weekend. Thousands of people marched to Times Square, where the Army recruiting station stands. And as an island of a couple hundred people made it to the middle of Times Square, riot police moved in and pushed them out. Meanwhile, in Denver this weekend, in Denver, Colorado, five activists unfurled a banner that read, "Wage Peace Now," from a crane under images of Gandhi, Martin Luther King Jr., the Dalai Lama, and Jesus Christ. The activists were arrested and charged with a Class 3 felony, which is criminal mischief, in what they're calling the first high-profile direct action of the budding pro-peace movement in the United States and against the military activity in Afghanistan. The activists arrested were Jaime Bucknight, Yuri Koslin, Harrison Fox, Ginger Cassidy, and Amy Johnson. We are joined on the telephone now by Amy Johnson, who also works at Pacifica affiliate KGNU in Boulder. Welcome to Democracy Now! in Exile.
Thank you.
Well, can you tell us a little more about this banner and who organized it?
Well, it's a collective group called La Mitzvah, and it's a collective that is based on nonviolence and direct action, and we use a lot of humor and public displays of art to kind of get our message out. And there was five of us, and we climbed a crane right in downtown Denver, close to one of the main boulevards and the interstate that passes right through the city, and unfolded the banner early in the morning and left it up there for a couple of hours, and it was just a pretty powerful experience, to say the least.
So how did you climb the crane?
We're all climbers, and we used our climbing gear. So we were really, really, really cautious and very protective of all of our gear, and went to pretty extreme lengths to make sure that everything was secure and that we were safe.
And how did the police get you?
Well, after a couple of hours of hanging the banner, we climbed up and pulled the banner back up and put it in our backpack and climbed down and gave ourselves over to the police.
And again, describe the banner for us.
It was a 70 by 40 foot banner that said "Wage Peace Now," and it had the Dalai Lama, Martin Luther King Jr., Jesus Christ, and Gandhi on it, all with images of just their faces.
And what was the response? What kind of coverage did you get?
We got a couple pieces of good coverage from some local stations. Overall, not as much coverage as we think it should have gotten. We're still kind of waiting. The newspapers really didn't give us much coverage. I mean, I heard that there was one little excerpt in the Denver newspaper that was, you know, maybe an inch long at the most, you know, followed by pages and pages of the pro-war propaganda.
And finally, the feeling in your community in the Boulder, Denver area around what's happening right now outside of your group?
Yeah, well, I think everybody's feeling a deep sorrow and sympathy for the victims of last week's attack, as well as the families, you know. It's just horrific. But I think that people are just, they're really hurt, and they're wanting justice. And, you know, what's in the media is basically the whole drumbeat for war. And I think that people are reacting a lot on just that one message and not knowing that there's so many other messages and other paths to peace and justice than just this one. And, you know, and people are definitely very emotional, and they have a right to be very emotional. But our concern is that there needs to be more dialogue around this issue in the airwaves and the media. Just need to open it up to more voices so that people can really make educated decisions on what we should do.
Amy Johnson, I want to thank you for being with us, one of five peace activists who climbed a crane on Saturday and unfurled a banner that said, "Wage Peace Now." You're listening to Democracy Now! in Exile's War and Peace Report, broadcasting, just blocks from where, near where more than 6,000 people are either incinerated or entombed, where the towers of the World Trade Center once stood. When we come back, we'll be joined by Jennifer Harbury talking about the loosening of restrictions, about putting human rights abusers on the CIA payroll. Also, we'll look at the policy of assassinations and should this be acceptable in a civilized society. Finally, Rabbi Michael Lerner and Jim Wallace will join us, peace churches and synagogues, talking about how they're mobilizing. In our second hour, for those stations that are staying with us, we'll be doing a teach-in on Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, and Kazakhstan, and we'll also go to Britain to find out about the anti-war protests there. Stay with us. Kill for Peace, the Fugs, here on Democracy Now! in Exile, War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The World Trade Center and Pentagon attacks have led to harsh congressional criticism of alleged intelligence failures by the FBI and CIA and calls for a rapid expansion of their budgets and powers. U.S. intelligence officials have responded by saying Congress should scrap legislation that prohibits the CIA from engaging in assassinations or using human rights abusers as intelligence agents. These restrictions, they say, may have hindered their ability to investigate and undermine alleged terrorist organizations. Human rights groups have responded with horror. They say it's not hard to find examples of what the CIA means when it calls for a relaxation of these laws on assassination and working with human rights abusers. Friday was the 25th anniversary of the assassination of Orlando Letelier and Ronnie Moffitt. Orlando Letelier was the former Chilean defense minister under Salvador Allende. Ronnie Moffitt worked at the Institute for Policy Studies. They were killed by Chilean security forces backed by the U.S. in Washington, D.C. On September 21, 1976, Letelier was killed by a car bomb in the nation's capital. The assassinations took place less than 2 weeks after General Augusto Pinochet's military regime revoked Letelier's Chilean citizenship in the midst of a U.S.-backed campaign against Chilean activists. We turn now, though, to Jennifer Harberry, who's personally experienced what this means. She is an activist and lawyer for Native American prisoner Leonard Peltier. Her husband, Ephraim Bamaca Velasquez, was captured, tortured, and killed by Guatemalan military officials on the payroll of the CIA. Welcome to Democracy Now! in Exile, Jennifer.
Thank you, Amy. It's good to talk to you, and thanks for all your amazing coverage of everything that's been happening.
It's great to have you with us, and if you can speak up as loud as possible, can you specifically address the issue that the administration has put forward in saying that in order to conduct adequate intelligence, human rights abusers must be put on the CIA payroll?
Yes, I think there are three basic points here. Number one, when the new regulations were put into place after my husband's torture and assassination, they did not prohibit the use of unsavory characters where it was really necessary by the CIA. All that a CIA person on the ground has to do is inform his superiors that he needs to work with that person to gather intelligence and obtain permission. And in fact, CIA spokespersons, interestingly enough, have been confirming that their attempts to gather intelligence have not been hampered by that restriction. Number two, I think we have to remember that CIA activities divide into two categories. The first category would be bona fide intelligence gathering to protect civilians, which is, of course, the original role and responsibility of the CIA. I think in the context of gathering information to make sure that a jumbo jet with passengers aboard is not hijacked or to prevent bombings or other acts of terror, that there is reason to have more flexibility, although I think that basic human rights tenets should still be in place. I think we have to remember, though, that the CIA has always carried out a second category of activities which were not within their original role, which is specifically to force our own socioeconomic requirements basically down the throats of neighboring countries. I would use, for example, the example that you just used, which is Chile. September 11th is also a very notorious anniversary within Chile. That is the anniversary that the CIA assisted Pinochet in literally bombing the Capitol building flat in Santiago, assassinating President Allende, who was legally and popularly elected, and herding thousands of Chileans into the National Stadium. I think that the shock of the Chilean citizens that day must have been very similar to what we ourselves were feeling as we watched the World Trade Center towers go down. And counted up to 5,000 victims, sadly, it seems much more. I think that the vast majority of activities by the CIA have, in fact, been to aid and abet acts of terror in other countries. I would certainly give the example of Guatemala, where we spent the last 35 years aiding and collaborating closely with the Guatemalan military, which was found guilty of genocide by the United Nations Truth Commission. They were also found responsible for 93% of the war crimes, which included the torture and disappearance of 200,000 civilians and the mass destruction of 660 Mayan villages. I think that we have to be very careful before we remove those human rights restrictions that are in place. They're to protect the sanctity of human life of all persons, not just our own. And if our government, without telling us and without our permission, foments hatred against all Americans abroad, I really fear that eventually more disasters will come home to roost within our country.
We're talking to Jennifer Harbury, whose husband was killed by Guatemalan military on the payroll of the Central Intelligence Agency. You talked about Chile. William Blum is also with us. He's author of Killing Hope, U.S. Military and CIA Interventions Since World War II. He's someone who knows about the U.S. government, having been a State Department official himself. Welcome to Democracy Now! in Exile.
Hi, Amy. Good morning.
It's good to have you with us. I mentioned Orlando Letelier and Ronnie Moffitt, killed 25 years ago last Friday, actually not in Chile, but in Washington, D.C. Can you comment briefly on their case and how that fits into the issues at hand today?
Well, that was part of what is known as Operation Condor, which the U.S. and six or so other South American countries were exchanging information about so-called communists or anyone that they thought of as being the enemy, and they jointly engaged in assassination attacks upon these people. On the question of the U.S. government or the CIA associating with so-called unsavories, we have to keep in mind that it's not simply a matter of obtaining information from these people. These unsavories are America's allies on the same side of civil conflicts. And we insist that these people are fighting on the side of freedom and democracy. And we champion their cause because it's our cause as well. And we do all kinds of things with them, including socializing with them. And these people even betray their own government on behalf of the U.S. So it's a very close relationship. It's not simply CIA agents holding their nose while they get information. These are close comrades, so to speak, of the U.S. government.
This is an issue that we have discussed before on the War and Peace Report, but Henry Kissinger is being paraded out on the networks as a terrorism expert. Now, under the criterion, it takes one to know one, maybe it would be appropriate, but that's not how they are identifying him, but as someone who fights terrorism. Can you talk, as you do in your book, about Kissinger's involvement in various terrorist acts?
Well, that's a subject which has been discussed quite a bit in the past few months, largely due to the articles in the book by Christopher Hitchens. I don't have to repeat all of that information. It's just his main crimes, Kissinger's, were in, besides Chile, in Angola and Vietnam. Angola is not too often mentioned in his context, but he prolonged that war. He was the chief cheerleader for the U.S. involvement in Angola, which in a civil war, which is still going on. And he lied to the Congress about it repeatedly, and that's one of his many black marks, which is not emphasized enough.
We're talking to Bill Blum, author of Killing Hope, U.S. Military and CIA Interventions Since World War II. Bill, do you see this, what they're talking about, a relaxing of rules to put, quote, unsavory intelligence sources on the payroll, because in order to infiltrate an unsavory organization, the people themselves would have to be unsavory to be accepted? Do you, have these ever really been tightened restrictions on this?
I would doubt it very much. And the same applies to the so-called ban on assassinations. That has never been enforced. The U.S. has been attempting assassinations on a regular basis ever since President Ford first issued a so-called ban against them, as recently as 2 years ago, we attempted to assassinate Slobodan Milosevic. You know, we dropped bombs on his house, and if that isn't an attempt to assassinate somebody, I don't know what is. So this, besides which, the rule put in place by Ford was overruled and changed by Reagan more than once. So this has not been a continuous 25 years of a ban on assassinations. Reagan specifically issued orders to allow the CIA and other agents of the U.S. government to assassinate people. The media called it a license to kill. This was in 1985. And so it's gone back and forth. Officially, the ban has been in place at times, and at other times, the ban has been rescinded. There has not been a continuous policy, except that the desire to assassinate people when it was felt necessary has been continuous.
Jennifer Harbury, there are those who would say it is better to move in and try to kill one person that you have identified as responsible for a crime than bombing an entire population. What do you think of that as a justification of assassination?
I would have one major question for that person. Is there really some reason why that person could not be arrested, brought before a court of law, and given a fair trial? If that person engaged in combat with those attempting to arrest that person, then I would say that that death was a combat death or a death in the course of resisting an arrest. But if we are assassinating that person simply because we wish to assassinate him or her, and because perhaps we don't have enough evidence to bring him before a court of law, then I have very grave concerns. What is our excuse for avoiding the legal system and giving the person a fair trial? That's the third option that is never mentioned.
And finally, Jennifer Harbury, on the issue in your own case of your husband who was killed by Guatemalan military on the U.S. payroll, what do you think this will mean today?
In terms of the way we would carry out the new warfare technique?
That's right.
I'm very concerned that it will mean that the United States government continues to do what they have done in the past, which is to hire locals to actually torture, abuse, and extrajudicially execute prisoners that may be combatants and may also be civilians in order to obtain information from them or simply to impose terror locally so as to obtain their political goals. And I think that at that point in time, we're aiding and abetting kidnapping, torture, and murder, and we've become the very terrorists that we're seeking to quell.
Have people approached you, Congress members, senators, as they talk about relaxation of these restrictions?
I've been in communication with a number of legislative aides that I had worked closely with before, yes. And there are concerns, but I think right now on the Hill, there is an understandable and very human wish to take immediate action and to some extent to obtain revenge. But I think that we have to be much more level-headed here. And if we take away the human rights protections that have been so hard won during the past century, starting even with the Geneva Conventions, then I'm extremely worried about what is going to happen to our own young men and women in our own armed forces. If we take away those protections from those we are fighting against, then those protections will not exist for our own people. And I think that would be a very sad day indeed.
Ultimately, what do you understand happened to your husband?
Everardo was captured alive by the Guatemalan military in 1992. He was secretly detained, and they faked his death, saying that he died in combat in order to torture him slowly for his information. They tortured him for approximately 2 years. He was drugged repeatedly. He was beaten repeatedly. He was seen being injected with toxic substances that caused his body to swell grotesquely and apparently caused hemorrhages in one arm and one leg. He attempted many times to escape and was deemed highly intelligent and therefore placed in a full body cast to prevent his escape. He was also drugged repeatedly in an effort to make him talk, but apparently never did. When he was being tortured, it was under medical supervision to avoid accidentally killing him. Apparently, the Army eventually decided that no level of torture would ever cause him or force him to talk, and they decided to kill him. He was either thrown from a helicopter or he was dismembered and scattered across a sugarcane field in 1994.
And the people you did it, who did it, how you traced them to the United States and the Central Intelligence Agency?
Well, it took me nearly 3 years to find out what had become of him, including a number of hunger strikes, two in Guatemala and one, of course, in Washington, D.C. He was detained secretly by a very high-level group of Army intelligence officials, or G2 officers, in the Guatemalan military, many of whom, I believe up to 12 of whom, were trained at the School of Americas, and many of whom were, in fact, paid CIA informants. The CIA was aware that he had been captured alive and was being tortured in secret for his information, and so informed the White House and the State Department 6 days after his capture. Again, it took me 3 years to find out what had become of him. They were also informed while I was looking for him in Guatemala that he was still alive. In other words, if they had told me the truth when they received the truth, I could have saved his life. So we have the United States government literally paying their Guatemalan army counterparts to torture my husband to obtain more information. That is aiding and abetting. We also have United States officials standing in front of the door to his torture cell saying, "Don't look in here, there is nobody there." That's also aiding and abetting. It's also denying me my own rights to save my husband's life. This is exactly the kind of terrorist activity that I fear, if more broadly inflicted than already has been, and it has been broadly inflicted enough throughout Latin America, that is for certain. But if it continues to be so broadly inflicted on our neighbors and other countries, that level of hatred that is understandably fomented abroad, whether we as citizens know of these activities, condone them, or authorize them in any way, that hatred fomented abroad is going to have very negative consequences for all of our own citizens at home. And I think that's a security issue that has not been properly considered by our own officials.
Well, Jennifer Harbury, I want to thank you very much for joining us from Texas, and William Blum, author of Killing Hope, U.S. Military and CIA Interventions Since World War II, for joining us from Washington, D.C. And again, the top news story today that we read, just to remember, we're not only talking about putting individual human rights abusers on the CIA payroll, but President Bush has asked Congress for authority to waive all existing restrictions on U.S. military assistance and weapons exports for the next 5 years to any country he desires. These restrictions were put in place because of countries with massive human rights abusing records, like Indonesia. You are listening to Democracy Now! In Exile's War and Peace Report. We'll be back in a minute. Wake Up, Neville Brothers, here on Democracy Now! in Exile's War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Coming up, we're going to talk about religious leaders and peace in these days leading up to war. But first, a little promo of our second hour. Jeffrey C. is writing a book on the Central Asia region. President Clinton spoke with the Russian president this weekend. In addition to that, Kazakhstan became the first ex-Soviet state to promise practical support to the U.S. war on, quote, terrorism. The significance of the Central Asia region, Jeffrey C., that we're going to be talking about in the next hour.
Well, Central Asia has long been the nexus for shifting superpower alliances, and we see that continuing today. We see that Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, and some of the other countries in the region are aligning with the United States and Russia against some of the more radical elements of Islam, and we'll be talking about how that process is proceeding.
We'll also be going to Moscow to look at the Russian response. In the days since the attacks on the World Trade Center and Pentagon, people of all faiths and even little faith have flocked to churches, mosques, synagogues, seeking comfort, prayer, and a sense of meaning in the midst of the suffering. Mainstream religious leaders around the country have organized interfaith prayer services proclaiming unity and preaching tolerance, such as the one held yesterday at Yankee Stadium that was attended by more than 20,000 people. It was presided over by the commander of the Pacific Fleet, who prayed for God to be on the side of the United States as it prepares to go to war. But there's been another religious response as well, one that mirrors the peace movement now springing up in communities around the country. Many prominent Jewish, Muslim, and Christian leaders are moving beyond mourning and prayer to mobilization and protest, seeking a religious response to terrorism consistent with progressive values and the likelihood of war. We're joined on the phone by Rabbi Michael Lerner, who is editor of Tikkun magazine. He joins us from the Bay Area. And Jim Wallace, Reverend, who is the editor of Sojourners magazine. He joins us from Washington. Well, let's talk about the message you are putting out right now, Reverend Jim Wallace.
Good morning. Good morning, Michael.
Hi, Jim.
Well, I think it is appropriate for religious communities to begin with a pastoral response to those who are in mourning. The grief in this country is something that we have not known internally for a long, long time, and that's appropriate. And to pray is very appropriate, and to go deeply into our, dig deeper into our spiritual roots. But the religious community must offer more than prayer and support for those who are suffering. It must offer religious guidance and wisdom for our response. And number one, that means, in my view, we've got to focus on the language of justice, invoking the rule of law, and try and move away from the language of war, which has no moral boundaries. Two, we have to defend our Arab American and Muslim fellow citizens here against the vulnerability they're feeling. And three, I think we have to see this as a teachable moment to understand the roots and causes of what's just happened to us. That's the prophetic word. But I think we have to do it in a very careful way, so that we don't sound like, if you will, a left-wing equivalent of Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson, as if, you know, in this case, American foreign policy, which I've opposed for years, and American militarism, which I am strongly opposed to, and, of course, U.S. economic global dominance, make it that we deserved, ordinary Americans deserve to be attacked. That's what Falwell and Robertson were saying about their grievances, of course, you know, gays and feminists and abortion. We must not sound like a left-wing equivalent of them as we talk about draining the swamp of injustice out of which the mosquitoes of terrorism breed. We have to do that, but we have to do that in a way that doesn't lose our connection with the American people.
Reverend Wallace, can you elaborate on that, what Falwell and Robertson have said? Because I don't think a lot of people quite understand who they are blaming.
Well, they're saying that somehow the attack America is God's judgment for abortion, homosexuality. I think they said the ACLU. I think they even blamed the people for the American way. And it was the most irresponsible, inappropriate. It was an all-time low for the Reverends Falwell and Robertson. One good thing maybe that comes out of this is nobody will listen to them anymore. But it was a terrible kind of thing to say. I'm saying that we must be careful not to sound like them when we talk about the sins, if you will, of American foreign policy, of which there are many, and U.S. global domination and militarism and so on. I'm opposed to U.S. policy in the Middle East. I was on the West Bank in Gaza. Michael's been a prophet on this, calling for a just solution there. We must do that, but we must be careful how we do it, that we don't lose our connection to the American people. Michael, you've got a better sense of that than most people.
Rabbi Michael Lerner.
Well, of course, I feel that this is, I agree with everything Jim has said, and think that we certainly need to approach these issues with a sense of concern for the pain of the American people and the legitimate anger and upset that people experience at this moment. At the same time, this is also a particularly good week from the Jewish standpoint for atonement. This is the week of the Day of Atonement, and it seems to me that the entire world needs a period of atonement to understand what it is that is at the root of this level of violence, and to recognize that we're all implicated in it. In my view, we live in one world system, and that one world system is screwed up. It's screwed up because we have all learned to look at every other human being primarily in terms of how they can be of use to us, how we can advance our own interests, how they can be helpful, how they can be made an instrument of our will. We've unlearned. We've not been able to recognize other human beings as created in the image of God, and that is a root problem, which then reflects in the whole economic worldview that we have, which allows us to close our eyes to the ways in which we are implicated directly in the incredible poverty and incredible material deprivation that and the pain that follows from it for literally billions of people on the planet. So we close our eyes to all this, and then we're amazed that people are angry, or people are depressed, or people are crazy. People act in hurtful ways, and yet the hurtful ways that they act in are only exaggerations of the hurtful ways that are endemic in the whole lifestyle that is a product of the social, economic, political system that is ours and that is a worldwide system. So it's not a question of identifying America as the problem. There is a problem. There is a root problem. It's a worldwide problem. And the desanctification of human life that is endemic in our world system, that allows us to exploit peoples around the world, that allows us to live on 25% of the world's wealth with 5% of the world's population here, and simply be completely piggy about taking up the wealth of the world without regard to what's going to happen to the rest of the world, that can allows us to turn our backs on the fate of others as we avoid or reject every ecological treaty, that allows us to turn our backs on the fate of others as we fund military regimes around the world. All of that a reflection of the ability to desanctify other human beings, to not take the value of other human beings seriously. Well, that ethos has become a worldwide ethos, and allows finally for some person in outrage at that system to inappropriately treat us the exact same way, to desanctify our human life, to think that our human life is irrelevant, that to think that it's perfectly appropriate to murder in the name of their ideals.
Rabbi Lerner, these are the days of awe in the Jewish faith between the High Holy Days, Rosh Hashanah, and coming up Yom Kippur, the one-day fast of the year, the Day of Atonement. How are you organizing? And we only have 4 minutes here, and I want to ask how Reverend Jim Wallace is mobilizing communities of faith right now.
Well, we at Tikkun Magazine have started a new organization that actually this week, as a result in part of what's going on in the world, called the Tikkun Community. And we're trying to bring people from all faiths into the Tikkun Community. And one of the first steps is to ask people to engage in this deep process of atonement, in which we ask people to go inward, to look at the ways in which we as individuals have embodied the ethos of selfishness and materialism in our society. But simultaneously, we're asking, this is not only an inward process, it's an outward process as well, in which we want to challenge the, that ethos in American society. So we've put forward the idea of a social responsibility amendment to the federal constitution that would require corporations to reincorporate once every 20 years and only get a new corporate charter if they could prove a history of social responsibility in the way that they acted both domestically and internationally. This is a period for a fundamental transformation, and America would not face this kind of hatred and this kind of attack if America were being, or at least, let's put it this way, the terrorists would have a lot more trouble recruiting in a world in which America was seen as the number one force calling for social justice, for redistribution of wealth. If America was the force that was seen as the most generous and open-hearted society rather than the center of the ethos of selfishness and materialism. So we're calling upon individuals and also collectively for a worldwide atonement and an understanding of the way which we individually and our society collectively is implicated in the screwed up world that produces this kind of craziness.
And Reverend Jim Wallace, how are you organizing?
Very practically, we have a website, www.sojo.net, S-O-J-O.net. We have every day an email newsletter, Sojo Mail, that comes out of there with perspective on what's happening, practical things churches, synagogues, mosques are doing. We have a statement now signed by 2,000 religious leaders, Muslim, Jewish, Christian, across the board, Buddhist now, and that statement's called Deny Them Their Victory, a Religious Response to Terrorism. That statement is becoming an action network. You can get it off the website and sign it, and you can be a part of what faith communities are doing around the country, which is, number one, raise a voice that we not respond in a way that attacks and harms more innocent lives. Number two, that we protect Arab American Muslim citizens in this country who are under threat. Number three, that we use this as a teachable moment, that we look at ourselves and look at this nation and try and move toward a world in which the violence that is systemic every day that affects so many, and the terrorism that arises from that desperation, desperate people do desperate things.
Well, Reverend
that
Jim
we deal with that.
Reverend Jim Wallace and Rabbi Michael Lerner, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Reverend Wallace of Sojourners Magazine, Rabbi Lerner from Tikkun Magazine. And that does it for the program for this hour. We'll be going on with a second hour. You can mail us your comments at mail@democracynow.org. Democracy Now in Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, and Miranda Kennedy. Anthony Sloan, our music maestro and engineer. Errol Maitland is at the helm at www.wbix.org, where you can hear us. Special thanks to Chase Pearson, Tony Riddle, Rick Youngers, Hoy No, Karen Renucci, Dee Dee Halleck, Lenny Charles, Lizzie Ratner, and Sam Delgado, and our hosts at Downtown Community Television, John Alpert and Keiko Suno. Thank you to Pacifica stations and affiliates, KPFA and KFCF, and all our affiliates. We are Pacifica. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening. From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now in Exile.
We're receiving some sort of pressure not to have a political conscience right now because it's supposed to be a time of warning.
Thousands protest in the streets of New York, London, and across Europe, and Russian President Vladimir Putin pledges to cooperate with U.S. military strikes against Afghanistan. Kazakhstan becomes the first ex-Soviet state to promise military support. We'll discuss the politics of Russia and Central Asia, as well as go to Britain for the latest protests there. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now in Exile's War and Peace Report. As we break the sound barrier, I'm Amy Goodman. President Bush has asked Congress for authority to waive all existing restrictions on U.S. military assistance and weapons exports for the next 5 years to any country if he determines the aid will help what he calls the fight against international terrorism. The waiver would cover those nations currently ineligible for U.S. military aid because of their sponsorship of terrorism, such as Syria and Iran, or because of their nuclear and offensive weapons programs or lack of commitment to democracy, which would include Pakistan and China. Separately, on Saturday, Bush lifted all military and economic restrictions on India. He also removed restrictions that barred Pakistan from economic assistance and that prevented it from making commercial military purchases from U.S. companies. The new proposal would also allow the president to lift restrictions based on human rights concerns that have been imposed by Congress on U.S. military cooperation with other countries, such as Turkey, Colombia, Indonesia, and others involved in massive human rights abuses. The Bush administration is debating whether to make the overthrow of the Taliban regime in Afghanistan an explicit objective of the upcoming military campaign against Saudi exile Osama bin Laden and his followers. This, according to senior U.S. officials talking to The Washington Post. Although President Bush warned in his speech to Congress last week that the Taliban must immediately move against bin Laden's cadres in Afghanistan or share their fate, U.S. officials are still exploring the practicality of ousting Kabul's Islamic government. Secretary of State Colin Powell and other State Department officials have counseled that the United States be cautious about broadening the campaign's objectives to include the removal of the Taliban government, which is headed by Mullah Muhammad Omar. The debate over whether to seek the Taliban's downfall has parallels with a disagreement last week over whether the United States should widen its military campaign to target the forces of Iraqi President Saddam Hussein. Some in the administration, most notably Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz, pressed for action against Iraq. Powell countered that this would, quote, wreck the international coalition now backing a U.S. response to the September 11th attacks. The leader of Taliban militia said today the United States must withdraw forces from the Gulf and support the Palestinians in their conflict with Israel if it wants to remove the threat of terrorism. In a statement faxed to news agencies, Mullah Muhammad Omar said the death of Osama bin Laden would do little to remove the threat against the United States. The brief statement appeared aimed not only at warning the United States against military action, but also at encouraging other Muslim nations to distance themselves from Washington's efforts to build an international coalition to combat terrorism. Meanwhile, Mayor Rudolph Giuliani, who's barred by term limits from running for re-election this fall, is trying to extend his term. This, according to a source close to the mayor in a conversation with the Associated Press. Giuliani, widely praised for his handling of the city since the September 11th attacks, is scheduled to leave office December 31st because of term limit laws. For Giuliani to be eligible to continue serving beyond a second term, the New York legislature and Republican Governor George Pataki would have to enact emergency legislation to extend his term, or the city council and city voters would have to amend the city charter. Neither scenario is likely because mayoral candidate and city council speaker Peter Vallone, as well as top legislative leaders, have said they do not want to override city voters who enacted the term limits law in 1993 and again in 1996. Also, the city council speaker Peter Vallone is the Democratic candidate for mayor. United Nations Children Fund is hoping to begin emergency airlifts of supplies to people in Afghanistan, but badly needed food is still being held up in Pakistan amid mounting fears of a humanitarian disaster. Hundreds of thousands of people are on the move throughout the impoverished country as U.S. forces continue their buildup to possible attacks on the ruling Taliban militia and their ally Osama bin Laden. Children are particularly vulnerable as the freezing Afghan winter approaches, threatening to catch them in the open without shelter or adequate food. Afghanistan was already facing a humanitarian crisis before the September 11th attacks in New York and Washington raised the prospect of war with the United States. Civil war and drought had driven some 900,000 people from their homes in the year to September, and the UN had warned of looming famine. But with the pullout of international aid workers due to security concerns following the attacks in the United States and the massive movements of people fearing U.S. strikes, the situation has spiraled out of control. Several influential U.S. environmental groups have silenced their criticism of the U.S. government and stopped lobbying for conservation measures because of the attacks in New York and Washington. The Sierra Club, one of the largest U.S. environmental groups, last week dropped all of its work challenging Bush administration policies. Greenpeace, known for its high-profile environmental campaigns using civil disobedience, has also decided to take a lower profile. The attacks have rattled the leaders of environmental groups and made them wary of being viewed as divisive and unpatriotic while the country faces a national trauma. The attacks have also swept environmental issues off the political agenda. The decision by the groups to play down activism could have implications on a number of pressing public policy issues, including the U.S. response to global warming, the opening up of Alaska's Arctic Wildlife Reserve to oil drilling, and the development of the Star Wars missile defense system. Environmental groups in Canada have also shelved some of their efforts. With the crisis dominating the media, some groups, such as the World Wildlife Fund, have canceled events because they fear the activities wouldn't receive any coverage. And thousands of people marched across New York Friday night to call for peace and demand an end to attacks on Muslim and Arab communities. The marchers started off from Union Square, where mourners have been holding nightly vigils for the missing and the dead since the Twin Towers fell on September 11th. There, a father and his four children, ages ranging from 3 to 12, were singing to an enthusiastic audience. For our music break, we go there with Democracy Now! In Exile producer Chris Abrams.
Yeah.
the sounds of the streets of New York on Friday night, a family singing Hey Jude. Protesters moved from Union Square to Times Square. They were led by a huge puppet of a peace dove, protesters marching through Manhattan. In Times Square, police forced the demonstrators into separate streets, preventing most of them from entering Times Square, where the military recruiting station is. For our second hour, we hear more sounds from the streets with Democracy Now! in Exile producer Chris Abrams.
I'm Carol Khalil. I am a New Yorker. I am also a Newark United flight attendant. And I lost five of my coworkers on the flight from Newark.
And why do you think it's important to be at this rally here?
Besides being peaceful person. I am also an American with Arab descent. So for all these reasons, I'm out here.
President Bush held up the badge of a police officer who died when he basically announced that we're going to war. He seems to be using the people who died as a reason to go to the war. What do you think of that?
And that's why I felt like I had to put on just like Reverend Billy, I asked him first, I see you're wearing a costume. Maybe I should put on mine. So, because sometimes it lends to some credibility if you can show that, you know, if anybody should be mad, you know, like this one-upmanship of who lost who, it's, we've all lost, but I'm here because this is wrong.
The sounds of the protests in New York. We're going to turn now to London, where thousands of people took to the streets throughout Europe. Some 4,000 people demonstrated in London. They gathered peacefully outside the defense ministry, dressed in black and carrying pieces of paper saying, "Stand shoulder to shoulder for peace and justice, no more violence." Several thousand marched in Berlin, shouting, "No Third World War," urging the U.S. not to answer attacks on its cities with more violence. Smaller protests were also held in Cologne, Bremen, and Kassel. Another 1,000 marched in the Belgian city of Liege, and several hundred marched through the streets of the center of Budapest. And police in Istanbul, Turkey, yesterday detained 16 people when demonstrators from the Labour Party gathered to make a press statement denouncing Washington's threat of military action against Afghanistan. We're joined right now on the telephone by Carol Naughton, who's chair of the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament in London. Welcome to Democracy Now! in Exile.
Hello. Hi.
Good afternoon. It's good to have you with us. Can you describe what happened in London this weekend?
It was absolutely overwhelming. I mean, we decided only 6 days beforehand that we had to call a demonstration against taking military action, you know, before any military action was taken. And there were 4,000 people in London and Whitehall. We asked them to come in black to remember all the people who had died because of terrorism in the US and wherever, and to plead with our government not to support Mr. Bush in launching any kind of military strikes against any other citizens in the world. And 4,000 people turned out. It was completely overwhelming. And the feeling was absolutely tremendous against any war. But not only in London, there was 1,000 in Glasgow, and there was people all over the country, in Birmingham, Manchester, Leeds, you know, Cumbria. People turned out in the hundreds and thousands throughout the whole of the UK. And I just think that was absolutely wonderful, you know, overwhelming.
Can you talk about Tony Blair, the Prime Minister, who was just visiting the United States last week? He was at President Bush's State of, the joint address, his address to the joint session of Congress. He came to New York and came to Ground Zero. What England's role is with the rest of Europe right now?
I think if Blair is the friend that he's been, you know, set up to be of President Bush, then he will act as a friend and he will urge caution. You know, by all means, of course, no, everybody is against terrorism. We are totally opposed to terrorism. And we need to find the perpetrators. We need to address this, but to do it through the legal courts, do it through an international criminal court and the UN. That if Bush, if Mr. Blair is a friend to Mr. Bush, then he will be telling him that right now and saying to him, you know, do not launch military strikes or any ground troops, which will only fire anti-West feeling and create yet more terrorists all the way through Afghanistan and through, you know, the whole of the Middle East. that that's not the answer. You know, in the same way that all those people who died, the citizens of the U.S., didn't deserve to die. No other citizen of any other state deserves to die because of the policies of the government or because of a few terrorists who happen to live there. And that is Britain's role in this. Of course, set up a huge coalition against terrorism, but look at the real causes of terrorism. You know, why is it that so much of the world lives in poverty? Why is it that there's so much hunger and thirst? It's those things that create the terrorists that carry out these atrocities. And that's what we need to look at now. Why is there such a big divide between the haves and the have-nots, and address that?
Over the weekend, President Bush has ended the sanctions against Pakistan and India that were imposed after they both did their nuclear bomb tests several years ago. You're with the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament. What is your response to that? And has Britain done something similar?
I think it was hypocrisy in the first place to impose sanctions, given that United States and Britain are both signed up to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which commits them absolutely to the abolition of nuclear weapons in Clause 6 of the abolition of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. And they have done absolutely nothing towards that. They have made no moves for the abolition of nuclear weapons. And all that does is give them a seat in the Security Council. That is it any surprise that other countries who have tried over the years to persuade the nuclear states to give up their nuclear weapons and to fulfill their international treaties and obligations, is it any surprise that they then started to gain them themselves? And I think it was hypocrisy in the extreme to actually put themselves in a position to impose sanctions against other countries when they themselves are not fulfilling their obligations. But I do think it is strange that right now, when President Bush and when Mr. Blair are looking for the support of countries, Islamic countries, Muslim countries, countries in the Middle East, that they're just lifting sanctions. You know, it really is, it's a strange thing for the administration to be doing. You know, it's this. And that's the kind of games that have gone on over the years so much to actually, you know, to create terrorists where governments do support one faction or one country and then withdraw the support, then put it back in again, then put someone else. That's the kind of games that really, you know, they don't do this world or make it any safer. That we really do need to stop playing these games and really address terrorism and what causes it.
There has been a lot of coverage of the stories of people who lost loved ones at the World Trade Center, but that certainly extends beyond our borders to something like 80 countries around the world who had people working in the World Trade Center. I'm looking at a piece in The Independent titled Relatives Warning Against Retaliation, and it says the brother of a British victim of the World Trade Center attack warned against the consequences of killing hundreds of innocent Afghans. Rupert Eales White said his brother, Gavin Cushney, had been an opponent of American foreign policy in the Middle East. Cushney was a computer consultant for Cantor Fitzgerald, worked on the 104th floor of the North Tower, and remains missing and is feared dead. Eales White said, the ironic thing is my brother was actually a strong opponent of American foreign policy, particularly in Israel. He sympathized with Palestinians who he felt had been treated unfairly since the State of Israel was created in 1948. He went on to say, we don't want the terrorists to win and the perpetrators have to be caught. But if military action results in the death of innocent Afghans, then 100 more Osama bin Ladens will rise from the grave. How much attention did this story get?
I think it gets a lot of attention. I have to say, I mean, I agree with everything he's saying. And one of the things that really moved people, and there were people in tears on Saturday when I addressed the people who were there, the 4,000 people who were there, one of the things that really moved them was the letter I had in front of me from an American couple whose son died in one of the towers. And the letter was saying, not in my son's name, and was saying, you know, do not use my son's name to launch yet more strikes, to create more, you know, parents who are grieving, grandparents, carers, brothers and sisters, do not use my son's name. And I think that was one of the things that really, really touched the crowd who were there in London. And you know, that got a tremendous cheer. And in fact, we said, not in our name. And that's what that was about, you know, not... I fully agree. It will not solve this issue. Of course we need to punish the people who've perpetrated it. And our hearts go out to all those people who are still suffering, you know, families who've lost people. Of course our hearts go out to them and we feel desperately sorry for them. But to create yet more death and more destruction, I feel that that brother is absolutely right. It will just create more terrorists. It will create the climate where fear, anger, and retribution just fester, and that's what leads to yet more killings. So,
finally, Carol Naughton, in the United States, there's a very serious threat of crackdown on civil liberties, also a tightening of laws around immigration and new laws being laid down, regulations that would allow immigrants to be detained indefinitely, to have to go through secret trials without evidence, could be deported without evidence that they see. Is anything similar to that happening in Britain right now?
There is a discussion this morning about introducing identity cards or some sort of form of identity where people can be stopped and asked to produce them. And again, I think we need to be very, very careful here. If we're talking that we need to clamp down on terrorism, I would fully agree, but we need to do that with preserving people's own civil liberties. That to suddenly impose identity cards on people, to stop and search, all those kind of draconian things that may well be brought in, we need to be very, very careful that we are not just using them. We already have such things that are recognised in Britain as institutionalised racism within the police force, within other areas, and we need to be very, very careful that if we are going to introduce draconian rules and identity cards like that they aren't just going to be used to clamp down on a minority of people. And already I work within the Muslim community in Birmingham, and I've just been with some families who are Muslim, and the women are terrified to go outside, because if they go outside veiled or with a scarf on, they are really, really frightened of abuse in the streets. And I think that's so sad that, these women who have come through such a lot, and who I work with children with disabilities, and these are mothers of children with disabilities, and they're frightened to go outside their own door. And I really do not want to find that our citizens who live in Britain are facing the potential they can be stopped wherever for on any pretense. That we do need to be very, very careful of people's civil liberties, of course clamp down terrorism, but think it through.
Carol Naughton, I want to thank you very much for being with us from London, chair of the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament. This weekend, some 4,000 demonstrators marched through London's streets, some dressed in black, carrying pieces of paper saying, "Stand shoulder to shoulder for peace and justice, no more violence." You're listening to Democracy Now! in Exile. When we come back with our War and Peace report, we're going to find out about what possibly is in the air here in southern Manhattan. We're broadcasting just next to Ground Zero. And then we're going to do a brief teach-in on Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, and the Russian response to the military buildup around Afghanistan. Stay with us.
Mother of us all, place of our birth, how can we stand aside and watch the rape of the world? This the beginning of the end. This the most heinous of crimes.
Rape of the World, Tracy Chapman, here on Ground Zero Radio, Democracy Now! in Exile's War and Peace Report. the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Well, some 20,000 people prayed at Yankee Stadium yesterday as New Yorkers tried to reclaim their lives from the wreckage of the World Trade Center. At Ground Zero, hundreds of construction workers began moving the heavy equipment in as the official missing toll rose by 120 to 6,453. They're beginning to replace the thousands of emergency workers, firemen, police, National Guard at the site where the World Trade Center once stood. We are at a firehouse just blocks from where those towers were. And we want to take a look just for a few minutes before we go to Central Asia at what the air quality is in this region, as well as the response to a lawyer who is raising these issues. Joel Kupferman joins us in our firehouse studios in Chinatown. He is a New York environmental lawyer with the New York Environmental Law and Justice Project. Welcome to Democracy Now in Exile.
Good morning.
So what is down there? You've tested it?
We've tested it. We took ground samples and we sent them off to a lab, the same lab that the city uses, and we discovered 2.1% asbestos, which is twice the amount that material is considered to be toxic. And also we discovered quite a bit of fiberglass, up to 15% volume, which is quite dangerous to people breathing. We discovered dioxins and PCBs are being tested right now. And the trouble is that I've been speaking to a lot of workers down there, and many of them are not being informed of the dangers, and they're not given the right equipment.
The EPA has said that none of this is the case, that nothing is dangerous.
Well, I think the EPA didn't say nothing is dangerous, but they're downplaying it to just about minimal. That's, I believe, the EPA press office. I've been speaking to some people, middle-level people at EPA, and they are concerned. And I've been speaking to many, many other scientists, and they said there is a large grounds for concern.
Now, you tried to bring this issue into the courthouse the other day. What happened? Why were you in court?
I was in court representing a union worker on a different type of case, and I was just wanting to speak to the court officers, just to mention that there is problems with the air or whatever.
And just to let people know outside of New York is that the courts are right next to where the World Trade Center towers once stood. So they're in this environment here in southern Manhattan.
Most of the court officers that I was speaking to in the beginning wanted to hear more. And then a lieutenant came over with another lieutenant, asked for my ID, and told me that I can't speak at all about this issue, that the government said the air is safe, and that's the end of the issue.
But you were just speaking to someone on the side in the courtroom.
Yes. I was speaking to someone that I was told by the other officers that I should speak to, a union rep. So I think part of the problem is that the workers are not getting the word.
Is it true that a sergeant or someone in the police followed you around from then on to try to prevent you?
Yes, while I was doing my court business, which is quite distressful to someone, especially to a lawyer trying to do his work in a courtroom.
And they followed you around and said what?
From floor to floor. They basically, you should get out of the building as soon as you can, and we're about to throw you out if you don't get out soon.
I saw you at a demonstration. It was actually the Muslim rally, and before that at a teach-in at NYU, an anti-war teach-in. You were holding up a bag of some of the material you got at Ground Zero. But that doesn't mean that that's what's in the air, does it, when you talk about...
No, but there's a lot of indications that, more likely than not, that it is in the air, and the EPA is not releasing all their figures. They're giving us summaries. And my point, along with many other lawyers and scientists, is that if it is clean and safe, why aren't they releasing those figures?
So do you recommend that people who are walking around now on Wall Street, where we are in Chinatown, the workers at Ground Zero, that everyone still wear masks?
I think if you're very close to the site, you should be wearing masks. And if you're further away, you should be taking other precautions.
Why do you think this information is being withheld?
This whole idea that life is back to normal and life is safe down here is, I think, with the message the government is trying to get out.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us. If people want to get more information, is there someplace they can call?
Yes, 917-414-1983. And one thing we also recommend is that you grab samples if you're from your own apartment, the workplace, and send it off to independent labs to be tested just like we did.
Thank you very much. Joel Kupferman with the New York Environmental Law and Justice Project as we move to our teach-in on Central Asia. Kazakhstan today became the first ex-Soviet state to promise practical support for the U.S. military attack on Afghanistan. The president offered its strategically vital aerodromes, military bases, and airspace. The region could be a vital staging area for the attacks, which the U.S. says is harboring its prime suspect in the strikes on New York and Washington, Osama bin Laden. Meanwhile, conflicting reports swirled around much of Central Asia today as to whether U.S. troops had already landed in the region in preparation for anti-terrorist attacks against targets in neighboring Afghanistan. The Russian Interfax news agency, quoting unidentified sources, said three U.S. Air Force transport planes had arrived in Uzbekistan this weekend carrying about 200 U.S. troops and reconnaissance equipment. Russia's RTR television also reported the arrival of U.S. forces in Uzbekistan, but a spokesperson for the Uzbek president refused to confirm reports about the U.S. plane's arrival. In neighboring Tajikistan, President Emomali Rakhmonov said his country is also willing to cooperate. There are unconfirmed media reports that U.S. forces have landed there as well. Meanwhile, President Bush consulted with Russian President Vladimir Putin over the weekend. Putin voiced readiness to cooperate with U.S. military plans. In particular, a U.S. official said Washington has been assured that Moscow would not oppose any cooperation between the United States and Central Asian nations, which have collective security agreements with Russia. But Russia's concern that NATO forces will permanently root themselves in the lucrative Central Asian region and that the operation could destabilize that area. We go first to Moscow, to Fred Weir, who's a correspondent now for the Christian Science Monitor. Welcome to Democracy Now! in Exile.
Thanks, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. Can you start off by telling us what you understand Putin and Bush discussed this weekend?
Well, the obvious thing they discussed was use of Central Asian staging grounds and the former Soviet aerodromes, which are very large facilities there. In fact, the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan back in 1979 from those exact places. They're apparently very large, well-kept. I mean, the Soviet Union fought a 10-year war from those bases, and so the Americans will need them if there is going to be any sustained action against the Taliban in Afghanistan. And I think it's pretty much confirmed that at least two or three Hercules transports did arrive in Tashkent, probably on Friday, and disgorged quite a lot of equipment and a couple of hundred personnel who are going around out of uniform so as not to inflame any local sentiment, because Uzbekistan is rather delicately poised socially. And that probably also explains why the president's office in Tashkent refuses to comment on it. But it seems pretty certain that U.S. forces are building up there already and preparing to receive tactical aviation there for whatever strikes are coming.
Can you talk overall about the Russian attitude now to the U.S. moving into Afghanistan, which is basically Russia's Vietnam?
Well, the Russians have been very, very reluctant about this, and I think they still have no intention of getting militarily involved, and that's partly because of history. There really is an allergy, if you can use that word, in the entire Russian establishment to any direct involvement in Afghanistan, call it the Afghan syndrome or something. In a larger way, they're really nervous about the consequences. They know that the present terrorist threat actually was spawned by their own intervention in Afghanistan in the 1980s. You know, tens of thousands of Arab volunteers came to fight against the Soviets in Afghanistan. They were trained and equipped with sophisticated weapons by the CIA, and they stayed on to fight for the Taliban after the Soviet withdrawal, and they created this much larger, this pan-Islamic, very radical, extremist idea, which is being exported now to countries around the region. Uzbekistan has very, very strong, I don't know whether it's the right way to say Islamic extremist, but this kind of very, very angry movement, because it's really an impoverished country, has a huge unemployed urban population, male population. This is the kind of situation which is very ripe for people to inject some kind of rebellious, angry, ideology, and this is exactly what's happening. So President Karimov has already faced one very, very well-engineered assassination attempt in 1997. The Islamic movement of Uzbekistan, which is closely aligned with the Taliban, invaded last year, and there were pitched battles that killed 200 Uzbek soldiers. The situation in Uzbekistan is very, very delicate, and the Russians do fear that if there are waves of refugees as a result of any sustained or perhaps botched American action in Afghanistan, that this will create tidal waves that will soon be wrapping on Russia's southern door.
We're also joined in the studio by Jeffrey C., who is a New York-based writer who's lived in Central Asia and is currently writing a book about nuclear issues in the region. Can you elaborate on this understanding of Central Asia?
Well, first, it's very important to realize that U.S. involvement in this region militarily is not new. There is an assumption that U.S. forces in Uzbekistan and military involvement in Kazakhstan is something that has just occurred in the last week. A story that got very little publicity at the time is that just 4 years ago, in 1997, the United States held joint military exercises in Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan with Russia, those two countries, Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, and involvement by forces from Turkey, Latvia, and Georgia as well. These were called Centrasbat, which stood for Central Asian Battalion, a unified military quick reaction force that was formed at the initiative of the United States. At the time, the cover story for why the United States was holding these exercises, which involved 500 U.S. Army paratroopers in Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan, as well as Navy SEAL team exercises, was that this was for potential rapid deployment in the case of natural disasters, like earthquakes or other such events. It was a very thin cover story at the time. There was widespread recognition among those sources who followed Central Asian events that the formation of this military force 4 years ago was in fact intended for the potential of the necessity for intervention in Afghanistan or perhaps in Iran or Iraq, or for potential protection against instability in China, that is, joint U.S., Russian, and Central Asian cooperation against the potential for instability anywhere within the region.
We're going to break for stations to identify themselves. When we come back, we'll talk more about the significance of these different countries joining the overall alliance that the United States is putting forward, what it will mean for their governments and what it means for the balance of power between the United States and Russia, Moscow, where Fred Weir is right now, Jeffrey C. in the studio with us. You are listening to Democracy Now! in Exile's War and Peace Report. We're also broadcasting on MNN, Manhattan Neighborhood Network, on Channel 34, where we'll be for the next 3 days, and then we'll move to Channel 56. You can tell people around the country that they too can receive us on public access. And we're broadcasting on Dish Network as well through Free Speech TV. That's FS TV based in Boulder, Colorado. You're listening to the War and Peace Report. We'll be back in a minute.
Oh, my name, it means nothing. And my age, it means less. For the country I come from is called the Midwest. I was taught and brought up to the laws to abide, that the land that I live in has God on its side. All the history books tell it, they tell it so well. The cavalry's charge and the Indians fell. The cavalry's charge.
With God on our side, you're listening to Democracy in Exile's War and Peace Report, Free Speech Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue our teaching on the Central Asia region of Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, with Fred Weir, a Christian Science Monitor reporter in Moscow, and Jeffrey C., who is a writer in New York who has spent time in the Central Asia region and is writing a book on the area. Can you place, Jeffrey C., this area for us? How big is it? Where exactly is it, so people can understand geographically?
Well, sometimes it's referred to as Inland Asia. It's the part of Asia that is literally sort of the hole in the donut that's far from ocean. It is comprised of countries that owe their historical development to the rivalry and warfare between major powers. Historically, the region emerged in its modern form from something called the Great Game, which was a superpower rivalry between the British Empire during the 19th century, which was lodged in India, the Russian Empire, and the Chinese. And these three competed for control over the interior of Asia. And the form that these countries that now exist inside Asia took were a result of the Great Game, which was a brutal, many, many decades long strategic experimentation that involved proxy warfare, horrible covert atrocities committed, acts of terror committed routinely, sponsored by often one did not know exactly whom, shifting alliances that sometimes shifted overnight. And we are now seeing really the continuation of the Great Game. It's very, very interesting that Afghanistan, as an independent country, emerged along with Mongolia and Nepal, two other Central Asian countries, as a buffer state between imperial armies, Afghanistan between the British and India and the Russians, Mongolia between Russia and China, and Nepal between China and British India. And Afghanistan attained its independence only in 1919, interestingly, at a time when the British-Russian rivalry of the 19th century gave way to British-Russian alliance during World War I. That allowed Afghanistan to emerge, and we are now at a time when we again have a situation in the post-Cold War world of a rough alliance between Russia and the West.
Bringing this to today, Fred Weir, we see in Afghanistan the Taliban government, and there's also the Northern Alliance, which claims about 5 to 10% of the land. Its leader was just killed, Massoud. He was assassinated. And I'm looking at a piece that talks about how it's also known as the United Front, and the Northern Alliance combines the minority ethnic Tajik, Uzbek, and Hazara tribes, and that Rabbani, which heads the alliance, the man who heads the alliance, is a Tajik, also president of the government the Taliban ousted from Kabul in 1994. Can you comment on that, Fred Weir?
Yeah, I think it's important to note, although that was a very, very good summary, that for most of that time, for most of the 19th century, and including today, Afghanistan was pretty much a no-go zone for everybody, and more than one British army came to grief in Afghanistan in the 19th century, just as the Soviets did in the 20th century. And it's partly because Afghanistan is a very, very hostile terrain with a multitude of component ethnic groups. No central government in Afghanistan has ever been able to take control, and they really only unite against outsiders. And that's why the Northern Alliance, well, it's been pretty stable through, you know, the last decade, or at least Tajik control in the north has been stable. It's not really likely or viable that it can be used as a springboard for taking over the whole country, because the majority in Afghanistan are Pashto, and the Taliban speaks for them. It is the radicalization of that majority during the Soviet occupation, which is really the source of all of Afghanistan's woes today, and probably it's from that base that the extremists emerged who attacked the World Trade Center a couple of weeks ago.
Jeffersey.
I think that's exactly right. The real danger in the region is that I think that the great powers, the Russians, the Chinese, now the Americans, who have substituted in for the British but are bringing the British back as our kind of partners in terms of our recent intervention, have used Central Asia as a testing ground for many centuries now, a testing ground for strategic weapons of war, for military strategies, and for new types of weapons. My book is about the use of Central Asia as a proving ground for nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons. Now, historically, the Afghanis and other Central Asians, but the Afghanis in particular, have been really, really superb at taking the weapons that were used against them or sometimes provided to them for use in proxy warfare and turning them against their former backers. That's how they have achieved some measure of strategic advantage. And now the problem is that the major powers have introduced into the region nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons, which are now subject to being converted and used by these very same forces. The Soviets put their principal nuclear development and testing grounds in Central Asia. More than 500 atomic and hydrogen bombs were detonated in and around the Kazakh steppe in the northern part of Central Asia by the Soviets. The Chinese did their nuclear testing in Central Asia. The Indians, the Iranians, and the Pakistanis put their nuclear development facilities and testing grounds close to the Central Asian region. And now the region is awash in nuclear technology, nuclear materials, biological weapons materials. I may add to that list that the principal Soviet test site and development center for biological weapons was located on an island in the Aral Sea on the border between Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan, an area where there are still grave security concerns about the potential for terrorists to go in and dig up anthrax and other biological agents that were dumped by the Soviets literally into the soil. That island in the Aral Sea is the world's largest dumping ground for anthrax bacteria. And I may mention also, in addition to what I said before about U.S. military intervention there 4 years ago, U.S. military involvement in training exercises, that the U.S. has been engaged in an ongoing basis since 1991, for the last 10 years, in extensive military operations run from the Pentagon to clean up, convert, deactivate, and transfer military and specifically nuclear and biological materials from the region, make them safe, bring some to the United States. We transported a plane load of enriched uranium from Kazakhstan in an operation called Project Sapphire. And the U.S. military is very, very involved in Kazakhstan and some of the neighboring countries in trying to stem the flow of these materials and technology in an effort that now takes on a whole new meaning.
Speaking of stem the flow, by the way, we're speaking to Jeffrey C., who is in the studio with us writing a book on the Central Asian region, and Fred Weir, who's in Moscow, the capital of Russia. You're talking about materials like biological nuclear materials. I want to also talk about people. Fred Weir, some are saying the immediate consequence of bombing of Afghanistan, whether or not Tajikistan cooperates in the action, is possibly an influx of Afghan refugees, many of them bringing weapons and drugs. This in an article I'm reading from Agence France-Presse, and the infiltration of hundreds and possibly thousands of Islamic militants into the neighboring former Soviet republics of Central Asia, that's what Russian officials are warning. Is this just anti-immigrant fervor, or is this a concern?
Oh, it is a concern, and it's anti-immigrant fervor, but you must add to this picture that Afghanistan and Tajikistan have been facing a two-year drought, and over 1 million people, perhaps up to 5 million, are threatened with famine. And none of these Central Asian countries, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, and Tajikistan, which border on Afghanistan, are prepared to receive large numbers of people. There will be a humanitarian catastrophe. It seems inevitable now that the borders have been sealed. Tajikistan has sealed its border with Afghanistan. Pakistan has sealed its border. All aid agencies have stopped their activity. So we're looking at already mass suffering, and whatever television pictures we're getting show huge numbers of people on the roads making for borders. And there's nothing across those borders to offer them any comfort, even if they can get across. So that is a major concern. The spread of drugs has been a huge problem already for many years. Afghanistan is the world's largest exporter of heroin, and much of it goes through Taliban hands. But frankly, a lot of it goes through the hands of the Northern Alliance. Is smuggled into Tajikistan, perhaps with the cooperation of the Russian army, which is stationed on the border there. This is really a snake pit in this respect, this region and the powers that operate there. And the other dimension that I think needs to be mentioned is that all three of these Central Asian countries, former Soviet ones, are some sort of dictatorship. Turkmenistan, which we haven't discussed because it's declared its neutrality, it actually has the longest border with Afghanistan, is a kind of North Korean-style hermit state with this godlike leader. Uzbekistan, which is now rapidly becoming America's prime ally in the region, is quite a corrupt and savage dictatorship. Islam Karimov, who was the Communist Party ruler of Uzbekistan, responded to that assassination attempt against him in 1997 by closing down hundreds of mosques and putting thousands of devout Muslims into prison. There is no opposition, no dissent, and I think part of the price of cooperating with the United States will be, in the old-fashioned way, to embrace him as our son of a bitch and stifle all criticism of what is really a nasty regime. Tajikistan, which is a very close Russian ally and has a Russian army there, has gone through a cycle of civil wars and now has a sort of uneasy coalition between its own Islamic opposition and the secular pro-Soviet or pro-Russian leadership there. All of them very, very unstable regimes which can easily be toppled if there is a blow to the base.
I want to go to the issue of oil politics, Jeffrey C.
Well, oil is the other dimension that makes this even more of a snake pit. There were, right around the time of the Soviet collapse, enormous reserves of oil and gas identified at both ends of the Central Asian region, in the Caspian Sea Basin and in the Taklamakan Desert of western China. And the question was, given the region's distance from ports, how to get these resources to market. The region is considered to have many more times the available deposits of fossil fuels than Saudi Arabia, for example. There are four proposed pipeline routes. And when one looks at the potential routes, one understands a lot about the politics of the region and what's happening right now. The U.S. has backed a pipeline route that goes across the Caspian Sea through the Caucasus to the port of Ceyhan in Turkey, considered an American ally. The Iranians want a pipeline linking Turkmenistan up to their pipeline system, bringing the oil to market through the Persian Gulf. That would be the shortest route for most of the oil, but involves working closely with Iran.
And the oil companies that are involved, we just have 1 minute.
Mostly support the American plan. But another plan that the Pakistanis want is to build a pipeline across Afghanistan if Afghanistan can be stabilized or made into a Pakistani client state that would bring the oil to South Asia and to ports in Pakistan.
And the names of the oil corporations involved?
Well, Chevron is the largest, signed a $40 billion oil development deal in the Caspian Sea, but literally every major oil company is involved in the region because of the size of the resources.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us, just a start of this discussion, introducing a region of the world to people in the United States, which I think has gotten very little coverage. I thank you very much. Jeffrey C. is writing a book on the Central Asia region, and Fred Weir is with us, who is a correspondent with Christian Science Monitor based in Moscow, Russia. And that does it for today's program. You can write to us by email at mail@democracynow.org. That's mail@democracynow.org. Democracy Now in Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, and Miranda Kennedy. Anthony Sloan is our music maestro and engineer. Errol Maitland is at the helm at wbix.org, where you can hear us. Special thanks to Chase Pearson, Tony Riddle, Rick Youngers, Hoi No, Karen Renucci, Dee Dee Halleck, Lenny Charles, Lizzie Ratner, Sam Delgado, and Orlando Richards. Also to our hosts at Downtown Community Television here in the Firehouse, John Alpert and Keiko Suno. Thank you to Pacifica stations and affiliates, KPFA, KFCF, and all of our affiliates. We are Pacifica. And you can encourage your public radio station to air Democracy Now in Exile. You can see us on Manhattan Neighborhood Network, channels 34 and 56. You can urge your public access station to run us as well. You can hear and see us at Free Speech TV. That's freespeech.org. We are in the historic firehouse of Engine 31 in Chinatown, just close to Ground Zero. In exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of the Band and the Fired, from the studios of our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.